Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the show that takes a stack of sources, research, and expert notes and tries to distill it all down for you.
And today, we are diving into something, well, something truly glorious and messy.
A real existential question mark of a movie?
It's the 1983 feature film, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. And if there was ever a film that actively resisted being well-informed about, I mean, this is it.
Yeah, absolutely. So our mission for this deep dive is, let's say, straightforward but philosophically a bit daunting.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to dissect the film's unique and, let's be honest, often controversial structure, that infamous return to the sketch format.
Right, that deliberate choice.
Then we'll explore the stages of human life it so savagely satirizes, and then we'll try to analyze its really surprising critical reception.
And its legacy, which is so strange for a movie that's probably most famous for its, you know, sheer vulgarity.
Its willingness to offend absolutely everyone.
Everyone. And I think it's vital to start by setting the historical stage a little bit. This film carries a significant, almost melancholic weight to it.
How so?
Well, this was the last feature film to star all six of the core Python members.
Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin.
That's the one. It was their last film altogether before Graham Chapman's untimely death in 1989.
So in many ways, this movie really feels like the final, explosive, totally unbound artistic statement from the group as a whole.
Exactly. And structurally, it represents this conscious, massive U-turn from what they'd just done.
Right. I mean, if you're a listener, you're almost certainly familiar with Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Life of Brian.
Sure.
And despite all their silly detours, those films had a single, coherent story. A narrative spine.
A quest for the Grail or the mistaken identity of Brian.
But The Meaning of Life just throws that all out the window.
It completely rejects that. It's an intentional regression, or maybe you could even call it an evolution, back to that pure, fragmented sketch format that defined Flying Circus.
They're a TV show.
Right. There's no central hero here. There's only a central question.
And the only thing holding these wildly disparate, often shocking vignettes together is that thematic progression, right?
Yeah, just examining the various stages of human life, moving roughly from birth all the way to death and the afterlife.
And we should probably talk about the scale here. Terry Jones directed it.
Yep.
And while it has that signature kind of scrappy Python energy, it was produced on a budget of around $9 million.
Which for them at the time was a significant amount of money.
It allowed for a level of production value. I mean, you think of the lavish musical numbers, the massive sets, the gallons of fake vomit.
So much fake vomit.
Things their previous films just couldn't afford.
And that investment definitely paid off. It grossed $42.7 million worldwide. But to really appreciate the chaos of the final film, I think we need to understand just how difficult the writing process itself actually was.
Okay, let's unpack that. We've established that the previous films, they had a natural structure. But when the Python sat down to write The Meaning of Life, the sources all indicate the process was, and I think this is Michael Palin's word, cumbersome.
That's the one.
So why? Why was writing this film so much harder than the narrative-driven ones?
Well, the difficulty really stemmed precisely from that lack of a defined spine.
Okay.
I mean, when you have a quest or a biography like Brian's, every tangent, no matter how silly it gets, can eventually loop back to that central character or that goal.
Right. There's a home base.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For The Meaning of Life, the mandate was just too broad. The meaning of everything.
Yeah.
Palin observed that they wrote a ton of material, just immense amounts, but trying to force all these sketches under the umbrella of philosophy or life stages was a huge challenge.
So a lot of good stuff got left on the cutting room floor.
A lot of brilliant material that just remained unused or got cut out.
You know, you can almost feel that strain, but it translates into the film's manic, almost desperate energy. When they realized they couldn't sustain another quest narrative after Holy Grail without it feeling repetitive, they consciously chose what Palin called the loosest structure possible.
The search for the meaning of life itself.
It's the ultimate intellectual safety net for a sketch comedy team, isn't it?
It is. It's the highest level of meta-comedy. If the whole philosophical point of the film is to show that life is random or meaningless, or at least impossible to define simply,
then the film itself doesn't need a coherent plot.
Precisely. It grants them total artistic freedom to jump violently from, say, a Yorkshire Catholic family to an exploding glutton in a French restaurant. That structural decision is their single biggest break from their other movies.
And speaking of defining breaks, the title itself almost caused a problem, which led to this wonderful piece of self-referential humor.
Oh, yeah, the Douglas Adams story?
Right. So apparently, after they'd settled on the title The Meaning of Life, Douglas Adams, you know, creator of Hitchhiker's Guide, he contacted Terry Jones.
And he had sort of a scheduling conflict.
A creative conflict, yeah.
Adams had just finished writing his book, which he decided to title The Meaning of Liff.
L-I-F-F.
An uncanny, totally accidental similarity that could have caused all sorts of confusion, or even a legal headache.
But because it's Python, they just instantly absorb that potential disaster right into the material.
Of course they did.
The slight similarity, Liff versus Life, led directly to the film's very first gag in the title sequence.
Where lightning strikes a tombstone and magically changes the name on the marble slab from The Meaning of Liff to The Meaning of Life.
It's just classic Python. Taking an outside influence, even a potential creative competition, and turning it into a quick, clever laugh.
And it establishes the film's meta-awareness right from the get-go. They're signaling to the audience immediately. We know this is a movie, and yeah, we're kind of making it up as we go along.
So beyond just the sheer volume of ideas, that budget was the great enabler here. As we said, $9 million was substantial.
It allowed for things they really couldn't do before. The sources say it facilitated large-scale choreography and crowd sequences.
I mean, you think back to Holy Grail, they were basically just running through fields and castles with, you know, pretty minimal production design.
Absolutely. Here, the budget allowed for those incredibly complex, elaborate dance sequences in Every Sperm is Sacred.
The intricate set for the French restaurant.
And just the sheer volume of material needed for the Mr. Creosote scene. I mean, the practical effects alone.
It also paid for a more lavish, complex soundtrack with all these new original songs, which really differentiates it from the sparser music of their other films.
We're talking full orchestrations, not just a couple of simple ditties.
And Michael Palin explicitly connected that bigger budget and the freedom of operating outside the strict BBC guidelines to the film's overall tone.
He did. He noted it allowed them to be more daring and dark.
They could afford the expensive effects needed to create that really visceral shock, like the exploding glutton. A low-budget film might have had to pull back from that.
For sure. And tracing the origins of these specific daring sketches back to the writers, it gives you this fascinating insight into their creative process.
Like the opening hospital scene, The Miracle of Birth, that came directly from Graham Chapman.
Right, because Chapman was a qualified doctor himself. Yeah. He had an insider's view of the medical world.
So what was his observation?
He'd noticed the growing industrialization and, I guess, dehumanization of hospitals. The introduction of lots and lots of machinery, as he put it.
So his satire wasn't really about the act of birth itself.
No, not at all. It was about the overwhelming bureaucracy and the hardware that had come to surround it. That became the focus of the satire.
And that theme, bureaucracy just overwhelming the human experience, it runs so deep in their work.
It does. Palin noted that same thread applied to that later, equally grotesque scene with the live organ transplants.
Where the officials show up to claim the man's liver.
Yeah, that sketch links directly back to Python's long-standing love of bureaucratic absurdity. Specifically, sketches with tons of people arriving with different bits of paper, claiming jurisdiction over something deeply personal.
It's taking the mundane terror of dealing with paperwork and just applying it to life and death situations.
That's where Python finds its most fertile ground. They love the idea of officialdom just triumphing over any kind of logic or emotion.
And speaking of fertile ground, we have to mention this one tiny, fascinating production detail from the source material. It just illuminates how far they were willing to push the envelope on language.
Oh, this is a great one.
Even after they'd already secured an R rating in the U.S.
This is from the Yorkshire Catholic Family sketch. Michael Palin's line where he's explaining contraception to his, you know, innumerable children.
Right.
Originally, he recorded the line referring to the protective item as that rubber thing at the end of my sock.
Which is a slightly ridiculous, almost childlike euphemism.
Very much so. But during post-production, they overdubbed that audio.
So the word sock was replaced by the far more explicit and provocative word.
It's a cock.
It's a fast blink and you miss it detail.
But it speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It says so much about their commitment to direct, aggressive humor. They had the budget, they had the rating freedom, and they were determined to use the most offensive word possible to get maximum shock value.
Right in the middle of a conversation about piety and procreation.
That level of meticulous detail, even in a single word replacement, it just reinforces that they were seeking to push boundaries audibly, not just visually.
Now, before we properly get into the stages of life, we have to dedicate a good chunk of time to the short film that comes before the main feature.
The Crimson Permanent Assurance.
Yeah. Yes. If you watch the full theatrical version, the runtime jumps from 90 minutes to 107, all because of this unexpected, brilliant detour.
And this short film is such an essential piece of the puzzle. It's also a brilliant misdirection. It opens like a traditional feature film. You get the full title sequence, established characters, and it immediately breaks the expected Python mold by launching into this contained action comedy narrative.
It's totally distinct from the fragmented satire that's about to follow.
Totally. And the core concept of CPA is just so Python-esque, it hurts.
It focuses on this small, old-school accounting firm, right?
Yeah.
Filled with these elderly clerks.
The kind of forgotten souls who still use quill pens and wear, you know, arm garters. Their whole staid bureaucratic world is disrupted by the arrival of these new, ruthless, yuppie corporate masters.
Who are modernizing and downsizing everything.
And this leads to their fantastic, surreal rebellion.
They decide to fight back, but not with a protest or a lawsuit.
No, no. They transform their centuries-old office building itself into a fully functioning, seaworthy pirate galleon.
As you do.
And they sail it into the heart of the modern financial district, raiding skyscrapers and battling the corporate enemies for their gold. Literally.
It's pure genre pastiche, isn't it? It's using the visual language of swashbuckling pirate films to comment on generational and economic warfare.
It's taking the idea of corporate raiders and making it completely literal.
And the production story behind this short is fascinating. It was never intended to be this big, right?
Not at all. Initially, the script just called for the Crimson Permanent Assurance to be an animated sequence within the main film.
Okay.
It was slated to appear near the end, during Part V.
But Terry Gilliam, the visual engine of the group, saw an opportunity.
He's known for his love of practical effects, miniatures, massive visual flair.
So he persuaded the group to let him produce and direct it as a standalone live-action piece instead.
Exactly. Gilliam convinced them that the satire would land harder and the visuals would just be more spectacular if it were real rather than animated.
And it let him flex his directorial muscle.
Totally. He got to create this detailed, beautiful, and utterly bizarre epic on a smaller scale, giving him complete creative control over the short's tone and genre.
The contrast between the drab, bureaucratic life inside the old building and then the sheer audacity of it transforming into a high seas vessel is just, it's breathtaking.
That's the budget at work. It allowed them to pull off that massive visual joke.
The short stands alone so well that they had to figure out how to transition back into the main feature without just losing the audience.
Right. And the source material confirms that Gilliam managed a pretty subtle integration. You see one of the boardrooms that gets raided by the pirate accountants. It briefly reappears in the feature, a quick visual link.
And the most important transitional moment comes at the very end of the short.
The narrator, a CPA, apologizes for the interruption to the main feature.
Just before a skyscraper falls and crushes the marauders in this chaotic finale.
That metafictional apology is essential. It's Python giving the audience explicit permission to let go of the pirate story and shift their focus back to the fractured thematic structure of The Meaning of Life.
It clears the air, literally and figuratively, before the film proper even begins. It's a fantastic, expensive, and totally unexpected cinematic appetizer. All right, now we jump into the main event. The film is structured chronologically, and it launches straight into the fundamental questions of existence before we even get to the delivery room.
It starts with one of the most brilliant, self-aware framing devices in the whole Python catalog, the aquarium scene.
Right, the fish.
Six fish in a restaurant tank. They're observing the world, and the moment they see their friend get eaten by a diner, they're launched into this urgent, hopeless debate about the meaning of life.
They are literally viewing existential dread through the lens of being someone else's dinner.
It's the ultimate statement on human, or I guess, piecing insignificance.
Then we move to the first stage, the miracle of birth. And as we touched on, this scene is all about bureaucracy just suffocating the human experience.
The doctors are completely obsessed with their presentation to the hospital administrator. They're focused on the equipment, the cost, the sheer industrial spectacle of the delivery room.
They completely ignore the actual woman in labor.
The patient is utterly secondary to the performance of efficiency and technological prowess.
It's a savage critique of modern medicine prioritizing process and profit over actual patient care.
Following this, the film pivots to this devastatingly sharp satire of religion and its relationship with procreation and poverty.
We travel to Yorkshire to meet the Roman Catholic man, played by Michael Palin,
who has to inform his numerous children that he has to sell them for scientific experiments because he's been made redundant.
The scene just immediately establishes the economic burden of pious adherence to doctrine. The kids, all packed into that small room, they're living evidence of the religious prohibition on contraception.
And this is where that brilliant contrast comes in. A Protestant man appears.
And he's proudly boasting that his religion allows the use of contraception and permits sex purely for pleasure.
But his wife immediately undercuts this theological freedom.
She just observes, so dryly, that despite the allowance, they never actually do it.
Right. The freedom exists, but they choose not to use it, revealing that personal inhibition can be just as strong as any doctrinal restriction.
And that whole dynamic is the perfect springboard for the film's most famous musical number.
Every sperm is sacred.
We have to do a deep dive here. We need to look at the power of this song.
It's not just a provocative lyric. It's an astonishing piece of musical theater.
Seth MacFarlane, among many others, praised it. He noted its incredible complexity, the high-quality orchestrations, and the beautifully choreographed staging.
The juxtaposition is the key. They take this tragic subject, a family struggling with poverty because of their adherence to a non-contraceptive mandate.
And they turn it into a lavish, almost Disney-esque musical production.
Featuring dozens of children dancing about the philosophical sanctity of every potential life form they represent.
It's tragicomic satire at its absolute peak. The song is delivered with total sincerity.
Which makes the underlying message, that pious adherence leads directly to economic ruin, even more potent. The beauty of the performance just clashes violently with the grim reality of the situation.
It forces you, as the audience, to confront the absurdity of doctrine when it's applied to reality.
Then, moving on, the film transitions to growth and learning, Python's take on education. We start with a lesson on school etiquette. That just descends into pure traditional Python anarchy.
But that's just the warm-up, really.
The real shock comes with the surreal and profoundly awkward sex education lesson.
The students are forced to observe their teacher, John Cleese, having sex with his wife in this clinical, uncomfortably formal demonstration.
It's the ultimate example of pedagogical failure through hyper-literal instruction. Python is demonstrating that the most inappropriate, clinical, and frankly bizarre form of instruction is what passes for practical education in their world.
The students are just forced into this state of morbid curiosity, not actual learning.
And what's the immediate consequence of breaking that forced atmosphere of solemnity?
One boy dares to laugh at the spectacle.
And his punishment is swift and completely disproportionate. He's immediately forced into this brutal, violent rugby match.
Pitting the adolescent pupils against the full-grown schoolmasters.
The connection is so clear. Institutional learning punishes genuine human reaction, especially laughter or joy, by subjecting the offender to ritualized violence.
It suggests that institutions are actively trying to suppress the natural human spirit.
Next up, we hit fighting each other, the military segment, which has three distinct vignettes.
The absurdity of combat and the deep-seated class structure of the British officer corps are classic Python targets.
But here they're presented with a real cinematic scale.
The first one takes us to World War I, deep in the mud of the Battle of the Somme.
An officer is trying to rally his men during a horrifying attack, but instead of fighting, the men interrupt him to present him with going-away gifts.
A toaster, a tea set.
It's a brilliant, short satire on the entrenched, stifling politeness of British social life. The stiff upper lip and ritualistic gift-giving of civilian life just clash violently with the horrifying reality of total war.
The absurdity of manners triumphs over survival instincts.
Then we shift to the modern army sketch, with the famous RSM, the Regimental Sergeant Major, played by John Cleese.
And he's relentlessly bullying his soldiers, demanding they admit what they would rather be doing than marching drills.
The twist here is psychological, though. Instead of punishing them for admitting their desires, like going to the beach or having sex, he dismisses each one in turn to go do that very thing.
He reveals his power isn't just in forcing them to drill,
but in knowing and mocking their profound desire for freedom before temporarily granting it. It's a satire on the manipulative nature of command.
And finally, the segment concludes in 1879 during the Anglo-Zulu War at the Battle of Rorke's Drift.
The soldier gets his leg bitten off
and immediately assumes the culprit must be a tiger.
They hunt for this imagined beast, only to find two men wearing a ridiculously unconvincing tiger costume.
This vignette just encapsulates the Python love of finding a bureaucratic or absurd explanation for physical horror.
Even in the chaos of a historical conflict, the cause of the injury must be rationalized, however ludicrously. It suggests that sometimes The absurdity of war is only overshadowed by the sheer, bizarre incompetence of the people running it.
After all that, existential crisis, religious satire, and military madness.
Right.
We enter the exact middle of the film.
Which is literally introduced by an announcer, played by Terry Gilliam.
Right. He appears as the host for a segment called Find the Fish, with all these bizarre, surreal characters challenging the audience.
This serves as a vital structural reset. It's an explicit acknowledgement that the film is now structurally in total freefall.
It breaks the fourth wall entirely, inviting the audience to play a game that is as random and meaningless as the search for the meaning of life itself.
And of course, it fulfills the promise of the opening scene by bringing the fish back into the narrative focus.
Okay, so the next main section, Middle Age, opens with this fantastic satire of affluent, superficial American tourism.
We find an American couple visiting a profoundly strange establishment, a Hawaiian restaurant that is morbidly themed around medieval torture.
It's a very modern, cynical intersection of leisure, consumption, and historical atrocity. The idea that people would seek out historical suffering as an aesthetic background for their dinner.
It illustrates a profound moral vacancy.
And their waiter, played by John Cleese, immediately engages them in this incredibly detailed conversation about philosophy.
Plato, the actual meaning of life. This is the only character who seems to genuinely care about the central question of the film.
But the customers, they're all wrapped up in their shallow conversation, and they completely fail to grasp what he's talking about.
They pivot away from deep thoughts about existence to discuss the much more pressing issue of live organ transplants.
It's a perfect commentary on how quickly modern humans lose interest in existential truths when there's some high-tech gossip to discuss.
And this pivots us directly into the grotesque but highly structured live organ transplant sketch.
This is where that Python love of bureaucracy intersects violently with medical gore and public life.
We see paramedics and various officials arrive at a man's home and proceed to remove his liver while he is still completely conscious.
The satire is aimed at the casual, procedural manner in which a major organ is just claimed and removed, like it's a misplaced library book or something.
What's fascinating about this scene, though, is the moment of persuasion. The wife is initially reluctant to donate her own liver.
Until a character, a man stepping dramatically out of a refrigerator, delivers a philosophical intervention.
It is the ultimate logical leap of dark comedy. He reminds her of humanity's insignificance in the universe, justifying the immediate organ removal by framing it as a negligible act in the grand cosmic scheme.
The profound is used to justify the brutally invasive. She agrees, and away goes her liver.
And following this, we get that brief structural tie-in, a moment where executives are debating philosophy, only to be momentarily interrupted by the raid of the Crimson Permanent Assurance Pirates.
It confirms that Gilliam's short film is happening concurrently in the Python universe.
And then we transition to the segment titled The Autumn Years, but the focus is less on reflection and more on pure destructive excess.
It starts bizarrely with a French musician at the restaurant singing this cheerful romantic song about the joys of having a penis.
A moment of slightly misplaced, celebratory French absurdity.
But this is merely the calm before the storm. It's the prelude to the arrival of the ultimate antagonist of the film.
And perhaps the Python's most infamous creation, Mr. Creosote.
And the introduction of Creosote is pivotal. Python signals his destructive nature immediately.
As this ill-tempered, grossly obese glutton enters the restaurant, the six fish we met in the opening scene immediately scatter and hide in their tank.
They know. Universally, they know that the worst of humanity has just arrived.
And this scene that follows is the single most notorious and frequently cited in the entire Python catalog.
Creosote, played by Terry Jones in this grotesque makeup, proceeds to devour an enormous, utterly impossible meal.
All while continually and violently vomiting across the highly sophisticated dining room.
He is truly excess personified, a walking monument to gluttony and destructive consumption.
Creosote functions as this powerful satire of the era's emerging greed, that unbridled consumerism and grotesque excess of the 1980s. He's the physical embodiment of destructive appetite.
Demanding more and more until he literally explodes.
And the climax is handled so masterfully by John Cleese, playing the impeccably polite maitre d'hotel.
Despite Creosote's continuous vomiting and destruction of the restaurant, the maitre d's maintains his composure.
And he persuades the disgustingly full Creosote to eat just one final wafer-thin after-dinner mint.
That single additional item proves to be the catastrophic, inevitable overload.
The wafer-thin mint triggers creosote's explosive demise, splattering viscera and hundreds of pounds of fake vomit all over the other diners in this spectacular, repulsive finale.
It's the moment that defined the film's reputation for being aggressively, unapologetically offensive. And this is where the behind-the-scenes reality is almost as funny as the sketch itself.
Right. The filming took place at Porchester Hall in Queensway. And because of the logistics of the production, the hundreds of pounds of fake vomit and grotesque materials had to be cleaned up on the very last day of shooting.
And they were on a tight deadline. A real wedding ceremony was scheduled to take place in that same hall just a few hours after they wrapped the explosion scene.
Can you imagine that contrast? The pure, chaotic vulgarity of the exploding glutton scene forcing this massive, urgent cleanup.
Immediately preceding the pure, idealized ritual of a wedding.
It perfectly encapsulates Python's mission. Disrupting polite society and forcing chaos into expected order.
So after this literal eruption of gluttony, the film tries to bring back the original philosophical question. The cleaning woman enters, surveying the scene of destruction.
And she proposes a perfectly nihilistic conclusion that fits the mess. Life is meaningless.
A suitably bleak takeaway for the carnage we just witnessed.
Until she immediately ruins her own point by revealing, in the same breath, that she is a virulent racist.
And the waiter, trying desperately to salvage a takeaway, he attempts to conclude the segment by discussing kindness.
But he trails off in understandable anger, unable to maintain the moral high ground amidst the mess, the bile, and the bigotry. The search for meaning is quite literally drowned out by human flaws.
As we move into the final stages, we arrive at death. And the film offers two very different, darkly comedic visions of mortality.
The first features a condemned man who gets the unusual privilege of choosing the manner of his own execution.
His choice is classic Python, being chased off the cliffs of Dover by two topless women in sports gear, ultimately falling into his own open grave waiting precisely below.
It combines morbid wish fulfillment with utter finality, a bizarre, sexualized execution ritual.
That visual bleakness is followed by a short, animated interlude where despondent leaves commit suicide by throwing themselves from the branches of a tree.
A very quick, very dark joke about the universality of existential despair.
But the most famous segment of the final section is the arrival of the Grim Reaper.
The Grim Reaper, again played by John Cleese, appears at an isolated cottage where an upper-class British family is holding a dinner party.
And the Reaper has to politely but firmly convince the hosts and their dinner guests that they are all, in fact, dead.
Having died from eating bad salmon mousse, the bureaucracy of death is maintained even in the face of the scythe. They accept their fate and have to accompany him to the afterlife.
And what is the ultimate destination?
They travel to heaven, which is revealed to be the exact same tackly-themed Hawaiian restaurant from the earlier Middle Age segment.
It is the ultimate anticlimax.
The ultimate destination of human existence is just a tacky, recycled set from Earth. The grand mystery of the afterlife is reduced to a cheap rerun.
They enter a Las Vegas-style hotel within this heaven. They meet characters from the previous sketches, and a Tony Bennett-esque singer performs this sprawling, high-energy song about how amazing life is.
And the song is just pure consumerist fantasy. It highlights commercial items and the absolute certainty of comfort.
Suggesting that in this version of heaven, it is always Christmas.
The profound mystery of the afterlife is replaced by the shallow, materialistic paradise of perpetual shopping and lounge music. The great promise of eternity is just the worst parts of American tourism.
This glorious, tacky song then just abruptly ends, signaled by an announcement, the end of the film.
The chaos is over. We're finally ready for the answer.
The hostess from the middle of the film segment appears one last time, opening an envelope.
And in a dry, utterly bland fashion, she reveals the meaning of life. This is the moment where the film truly undercuts all its own high-minded chaos, its vulgarity, and the 90 minutes of existential exploration.
The official meaning, according to the film, is try and be nice to people, avoid eating fat, read a good book every now and then, get some walking in, and try and live together in peace and harmony with people of all creeds and nations.
It's the most banal, lowest-stakes self-help platitude imaginable.
After all the excess, the philosophical debates, the shocking visuals, the answer is to eat low fat and take a walk.
That intentional anticlimax is the film's final greatest punchline. It suggests the meaning of life was obvious all along, but humans just prefer complexity and destruction.
So before we delve into the philosophical implications of that ending, let's look at how the world reacted to this chaotic experiment.
Despite its often repulsive content, it was a solid box office success,
grossing $42.7 million worldwide against that modest $9 million budget.
But the truly shocking data point is its major international award. The Meaning of Life won the Grand Prix at the 1983 Cannes Film Festival.
That is an immense institutional validation for a film that features exploding gluttons, explicit instruction, and rampant bodily fluid expulsion.
It is. The sources noted that while the jury was fiercely split on many of the other films that year, The Meaning of Life had general support across the board,
securing the festival's second highest honor after the Palme d'Or. The irony of such an aggressively lowbrow, vulgar piece of work receiving such highbrow institutional recognition is just astounding.
It is. However, the critical reception at the time was fiercely divisive, which I think caters perfectly to your interest as a listener in multiple perspectives. Critics either love the anarchy or they despise the lack of structure.
On the pro-Python side, the enthusiasm was palpable. Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
He praised it as fresh and original and delightfully offensive. What more can you ask of a comedy?
He was celebrating the film's willingness to cross boundaries.
And Sheila Benson of the Los Angeles Times admitted she was laughing too hard to even keep track of all the offenses.
So for those critics, the humor and sheer audacity just trumped any concerns about narrative coherence.
But on the skeptical side, you had Roger Ebert, who gave it 2.5 stars. While he recognized it as a barbed, uncompromising attack on generally observed community standards, he didn't fully embrace the relentless anarchy.
He felt the sketches sometimes lacked the sustained wit of their previous work.
And Gary Arnold of the Washington Post was far more negative. He argued that the film's largely tedious attempts to burlesque human weakness were overshadowed by the group's failure to evolve a coherent satiric outlook.
So for him, the intentional return to the sketch format was a fatal flaw. It prevented the satire from truly landing.
Exactly. And Steve Jenkins in the Monthly Film Bulletin echoed this, calling the return to the sketch format a great leap backwards that just repackaged old ideas.
And yet, the film's ability to shock remains legendary.
We have to mention the definitive reaction to the creosote scene, which comes from an unexpected source. Quentin Tarantino.
The director, yeah.
He publicly admitted that the Mr. Creosote sequence was the only time I've ever had to look away from a movie due to genuine nausea. He couldn't bear to watch, fearing he would literally vomit himself.
I mean, that detail alone just seals the scene's status as a boundary-pushing masterpiece of the grotesque.
Absolutely. And the film's legacy is undeniable. It appeared on a 2010 list of the top 20 cult films by the Boston Globe.
And as we mentioned earlier, modern comedians and creators like Seth MacFarlane view Python, and this film specifically, as the great originator.
The great originator of combining deeply provocative, taboo-smashing humor with high-quality, lavishly produced musical segments.
Right.
We should also circle back to the censorship history, which really underscores its controversial nature upon release.
Like Life of Brian, it was banned in Ireland on its original release.
It was initially rated 18 in the UK, later reduced to 15, and was rated R in the United States. It was clearly designed to provoke and exploit the newfound freedoms of that R rating.
And for those of you who want the true deep cuts, we should revisit the specifics of the 2003 two-disc DVD release,
which featured a director's cut, stretching the runtime to 116 minutes, and incorporated several deleted scenes.
Scenes that were deemed too extraneous for the theatrical version.
And these deleted scenes offer great insight into their editorial process. They included the full segment, The Adventures of Martin Luther,
which likely explored the bureaucracy and doctrinal rigidity of the Reformation era. It was meant to be inserted after the sketch about the Protestant couple.
Cutting it was probably a pacing decision. While the Luther material likely contains some strong historical satire, inserting an entire biography segment would have just slowed the already fractured chronology to a halt.
Even more so than the Crimson Permanent Assurance.
Exactly. They clearly felt they needed to keep the pace of the chaos moving.
There was also a promotional video about the British Army inserted into the military section, which might have felt a bit too much like an older Python clip show.
And an extension of the American couple scene involving them discussing tampons.
That extended American couple scene is significant because it further details how that superficial couple discusses mundane, awkward commercial topics, tampons, mm-hmm. organ transplants with the same casualness they would discuss the philosophy of life.
Right. This material was ultimately cut to streamline the transition to the creosote segment, but it reinforces the idea that Python generated far more ideas about human absurdity than could possibly be contained in a single feature.
So, to summarize what we've unpacked, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life is this sprawling, fragmented, chaotic, and sometimes deeply offensive achievement.
It uses structureless sketch format to tackle the biggest existential question possible, jumping wildly from the dehumanization of birth to the tackiness of a consumerist heaven.
It's a film about the search for meaning that itself actively rejects meaning.
It prefers instead to wallow in the messy, visceral, and often disgusting reality of human existence. From the joys of procreation to the ultimate tragedy of gluttony and the sheer absurdity of bureaucracy.
It's an act of comedic rebellion against narrative structure itself.
And we leave you with one final, provocative thought to mull over as you reconsider this masterpiece.
The entire film is a journey of shock, awe, and chaotic excess, all culminating in that final, most anticipated answer. Be nice, avoid fat, and take a walk.
So if the final answer provided by the film is intentionally banal and anticlimactic after 90 minutes of total excess and boundary smashing,
does that fundamentally mean the meaning of the film resides entirely in the journey? The visceral, anarchic exploration of the messy human stages and the active fighting of taboos rather than in the empty, obvious destination?
Or, to put it another way, the meaning of life, according to Python, is not the answer itself, but the sheer effort of trying to find it.
Even if that effort involves a pirate office ship, a very serious discussion about socks and cocks.
And securing a Cannes Grand Prix after depicting hundreds of pounds of explosive vomit.
Think about that. Go be nice, read a good book, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.